It's 3:45 a.m. in Antelope, Oregon. And you're listening to Night Call. Hi guys, I'm Tess Lynch in LA, and with me are
Molly Lambert
and Emily Yoshida in New York.
Give us a call at 240-46-NIGHT or email us at nightcallpodcast@gmail.com with your burning questions, thoughts, ghost stories, conspiracy theories, anything you want to talk about. This week, we are going to pick up talking about Wild Wild Country because we've all almost finished it or finished it, and it's too good for just one episode. So, Molly, you finished the doc.
You finished it.
Oh, yeah. She finished it. She wins.
Yeah, there's like five more twists at the end that I was saying, as the doc is kind of slow paced. And then at the end, there's like a bunch of stuff where I'm like, hey, wait, I would like to know more about that part. Breezed past that.
There's so much Wild Wild Country content out there right now, and it's totally killing me because I don't want to read any of it until I'm finished. Like, but I mean, I've seen these headlines on Vulture, the site that I work at, just like, you know, the directors of Wild Wild Country still aren't sure who's right. And so at least I know that that's like still going to remain the same, where I have no idea how to even begin to think about who I agree with.
Yeah, we were talking about that because I was thinking it was really funny in the first episode we did about this. We were all like, seems great, guys. I don't know what could possibly go wrong with this, even though we knew there was like a twist.
Well, I had seen where they start poisoning people and drugging the homeless people, which is just, you know, A+.
That was a
you know,
point.
You know, you're on a great path when you're tranquilizing homeless people.
Tess was just saying that's when you turn on the cult.
I was also saying that initially we had kind of, we were like, okay, these people in Oregon are being pretty racist and pinning a lot of, you know, their reception to these people as being from racism. I mean, I think I assumed that the fact that they saw a lot of white hipsters following an Indian guru, and they were kind of like, okay, this seems threatening, this seems strange. So I automatically was not on their side.
Yeah, I mean, I think both things are true. I think the white people in Oregon are racist, and also the cult is evil.
I mean, the cult is so evil.
Well, what you realize is like, it's maybe just Sheila that's evil.
Well, and I think that there is sort of kind of the argument of, would any of this happened if the community had been more welcoming to them when they showed up? But also, and one thing that I think that the doc, as far as I've gotten through it, has alighted, and this goes to my secondhand encounter with Osho this past weekend, is I think that the doc has really kind of glossed over how prominent the sex aspect of the Bhagwan following, whatever, Rajneeshism, which dies in a certain episode, the one I just watched. They kill Rajneeshism. But still, it was like a really big part of it that they kind of mentioned at the beginning, like, oh, it was the sex guru. But that was a really big part of it. And the women... Go ahead.
Because I was already reading about cults a lot before this came out, just because we all are interested in cults and talk about them a lot. There's like a history of cults in America that are like Eastern religion themed, but then are like about sex. And so I was reading about, there was like a cult in upstate New York in maybe like turn of the century, I want to say, that was the first cult that like brought the idea of Tantra over to America and associated it with sex, which it was not. In India, it was like its own thing, but they like kind of rebranded it as like
made it sexier,
repressed Western, must go after all things horny.
Yeah, and the sort of Orientalism of like the mystical East, where everybody knows how to bone in a different way. but it sort of began this tradition of people having these sort of free love cults that are sort of Eastern religion themed, but really have nothing to do with Eastern religion. They just are, those are the trappings and style.
Yeah. It's like, it's just the same way that I think the townspeople on Antelope saw this non-traditional community where, you know, marriage wasn't necessarily a part of how communities were built and it was more communal. I mean, I'm being very repetitive here, but that, you know, that threat to the nuclear family always then becomes anxiety about sex. But like the inverse is true too, where you can, you know, want to have something that doesn't necessarily resemble a nuclear family, some sort of like utopian post-patriarchal situation, but then it always comes back to sex also. Like, I don't know.
I mean, the documentary did have some pretty great sex footage. I also thought it was super interesting, like, that even that spread out with that much land, that people are very NIMBY-ish about the sounds of the great sex.
I mean, that happening. Must have been some really
It must
amazing.
Have been great. And it was kind of blamed on the lack of trees. It right, was like, it's yeah. just echoing over the plains. I was like, okay, well, this cult seems fine. But yeah, I also was reading on Wikipedia. I mean, some of the Bhagwan's beliefs were a little more troubling than I at least heard in the documentary as far as I got. I just finished the fourth episode. But he had kind of like an end of days you know, thing going where he thought that everything was going to end in the 90s. And then he also, he kind of espoused like a form, Molly was saying, like, it's kind of eugenics-y where, it's built off of what I agree with, of like, if you're, you know, terminally ill and you want to end your life, fine. But then he kind of extended that to the idea that if you're unhappy with your body or someone else is, if you're not beautiful, like maybe get rid of you. And I was like,
yeah,
oh my God.
Mentally ill. It's eugenics. He's into eugenics. And he's like, his explanation is like, well, like if we don't take control of eugenics, like the Nazis are going to anyway. So like we better do like
Let's
eugenics
do it our
for
way.
Good, which is like not a thing. But I do feel like that's how a lot of like tech people probably think.
Oh,
it.
Totally.
Like,
yeah. Ours is
eugenics
the
eye
enlightened.
Yeah, eugenics has made a comeback. I was just thinking about it. I was like, the main difference between like girls in hoodies and Night Call is that we talk about like Nazis a lot more.
Well, you're finding a lot of connections,
hoodies.
Molly.
You know, it's all connected. I was reading about the Nike guy some more to try and find out more about that swoosh, which I did.
Do tell. Mm-hmm.
It is a alternate swoosh that's not used as much called a pinwheel swoosh.
Okay.
And what you can't really see in that photo is that there are like lighter, it's like two swooshtikas like over each other. So it's actually like an eight-pointed thing.
So it's like a sunburst with swooshes.
It's a sunburst with swooshes, but the way that it looks when it's printed, it's like
you just see the white ones.
It looks like a swastika. But I couldn't find anything damning about Bill Bowerman, the Nike guy. He seems like maybe he was fine. Maybe he was like a xenophobic, guy,
well,
but
he's like a Steve Jobs. He's like a Steve Jobs of sneakers.
Yeah. But, the Adidas and Puma guys were for sure in the SS. And I learned a lot about them. Their name were the Dassler brothers, Adi and something Dassler. Adi is short for Adolf. And his name is Adolf Dassler, and Adidas is his nickname, Adi Das. But they were Nazis, but they also decided that they would get Jesse Owens to wear their shoes in the 1936 Olympics. So they were Nazis, but also capitalists who were like, we're going to get an endorsement from this guy.
Whatever works.
That is going to win. And he did, obviously. He won 4 gold medals in their shoes. So then after World War II, when all the other Germans were broke, they made a lot of money by marketing the shoes that Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals in. So they were like sellout Nazis.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Anyway, streetwear. You learned a lot about the origins of many streetwear brands.
Well, I alluded to this earlier, but I did meet somebody who had met the Bhagwan.
I haven't
70s.
Heard this story. I'm so excited. Molly mentioned it.
Yeah. I mean, it was maddening because I spent the weekend in the Hamptons, which sounds fancier than it was. I just like stayed in a room in a lady's house in the Hamptons, which was actually quite nice. But, she was like obviously kind of like an aged hippie. She had like some Buddhas in the room and some crystals and stuff. It was very chill. And like totally in the previous generation way of having Buddhas and crystals in your room, not the like millennial way. Like I was actually quite relaxed.
Not like
by it.
Stark minimalism.
Yeah,
with, like,
no, it was
crystal.
Definitely not a minimalist. There was a lot of stuff. So she was very sweet, but then she gave me a ride back to the train and we were just talking about, she knew that I wrote about movies, and then we were talking about TV and how she had been binging a show on Netflix. And I was like, oh, the one I'm working on is Wild Wild Country. And she didn't know about it. And I started to describe it for her. And she's like, oh, before I could even finish, she was like, oh, I met him in the 70s in India. She said that, and this was like 30 seconds before she dropped me off. Otherwise I would have just like peppered her with questions. But she said that she had been immediately put off by the sex cult stuff. Which is interesting because you don't meet those people in the doc. You don't meet the people who met him and were like, not for me. You meet the people who immediately were enchanted by his eyes and felt like they had to start crying and kissing his feet and whatever. So, you know, there's probably plenty of people who were like, yeah, this doesn't feel like my guru, not my guru.
I like the idea of somebody who's like down enough to be like, well, I'm looking for someone, and then be like, no, this person is bullshit.
I mean, the fact that she was in, I think she was in Bombay, in the 70s, and, you know, was likely with a group of people who were like, hey, we're going to go see this guy we've been hearing about.
Well, without spoiling anything, Tess and I were saying there's one Oregonian guy that is really likable.
I know who you're talking about. The overalls guy?
Yeah. Overalls guy is really cool and smart. And at the end, he kind of like sums everything up. And he's like, you know, like, do I think he's a con man? Like, yeah, I think it was a con the whole time. And he's like, but I think like it was the 70s. There were all these Europeans like flocking to India looking for like answers and guidance and like wanting to believe in something. And this guy took advantage of that. But like, these people wanted to be taken advantage of, you know? Yeah.
And he also provided, I mean, if you're a Westerner who's looking for enlightenment in some kind of figure like him, the guy who's like, hey, you can totally drink champagne and be a capitalist and everything and also be enlightened.
Totally.
Like, that's the most attractive.
You can have all the sex with none of the like asceticism, which is like, you know, none of the, like, you don't have to give up anything. You just get to, like, indulge in everything even more so.
Yeah.
And everything good will happen to you.
I would have fallen for it so many steps along the way. I think that the first thing that really impressed me was the fact that this cult was able to build such a nice house for Sheila in what seemed like no time.
She said they were working around the clock. Texting me and was like, how did they build an airport?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's impressive. And when you start to think that, according to Sheila, which obviously this is kind of proven wrong because Bhagwan was taking Valium and nitrous oxide later on. But if it was a cult where, you know, drinking and drugs had been kind of replaced by sex and spirituality, I was kind of like, wow, it made them so industrious. I mean, they just made this really, all these mid-century houses all looking great. And the farming aspect was great. I think, you know, it's really, for me, it was really astounding when they bust in a bunch of homeless people to sway the election.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you don't feel bad for the people in the cult necessarily because they like are willingly buying into being exploited. It's like the people who go to the haunted house. You're like,
I think many of them willingly bought into the lie they were being sold, that this religion was open to everyone, that America had turned its back on the homeless people, a lot of whom were veterans. I mean, I was kind of like, I wonder if I would have smelled a rat at that point.
Well, no, because you're like, I want to believe that they really just want to take care of people who really need it.
Yeah, that would have felt like putting your money where your mouth is, really. Like, okay, if we really believe like this is a philosophy for everybody, then we should be opening our doors to everybody. But yeah, it obviously...
In a way, it was much more disturbing to me than the bioterrorism, but that's probably because the result of the bioterrorism was not as intended.
Well, they were also doing bioterrorism on the homeless people.
The variety of bioterrorism I thought was, I was astounded. I mean, I find this a very difficult thing to binge because
it's slow.
Not only because it's slow, but because it does kind of load it emotionally. I mean, it's very even-handed. I think that that's the most frequent, you know, praise and criticism, is that it's so even-handed. The first episode is really just devoted to winning you over to the cult a bit before kind of
doing
Sheila
the reverse. Is like a very charming sociopath, as we were talking about a little bit. The lawyer guy, I'm like not a fan of, but he's also like such a type. I realized halfway through that he looks like Bob Weir from The Grateful Dead.
Oh, yeah. Well, he feels like somebody that you 100% know. He feels like a friend of your parents or something.
He's such like a yuppie.
They all feel like friends of my mom. Like, that's
well,
also
I asked my parents. I was like, did you know anyone who like joined? And they were like, well, not that one.
Yeah.
No, it also just seemed like people in the 80s really like longing for the 70s. You know, a lot of it seemed to be a response
totally.
To the
people
changing.
People who are like in the bubble, who yeah. are like, you know what? I don't, but at the same time, it's so 80s because it's so capitalist.
It is right. But couldn't you see, I mean, in terms of these people reminding you of parents, friends, couldn't you see them at the dinner table kind of talking about like the things they miss, like, even yeah. just the flowy robes.
Well, yeah. it's like the change you can see between like the O's of maybe our generation being, you know, into, I don't know. You can fill in your own blanks here. But like, for example, like scummy rooftop parties and like yes. people doing circuit bending on the roof or whatever, etc.
Circuit bending.
Fill in your
I
own.
I would join the circuit bending cult 100%.
Is, you know what? But, I think you have an idea.
Yeah. But then it gets. As you get older, as you move on to your 30s and 40s or whatever, then you find the more comforting, like, don't need to challenge capitalism and the social structure that much version of that. Like, you find kind of comfort version.
I think that split is super interesting, obviously, that thing of, like, the people who at the end of the 70s were like, okay, back to capitalism, like, yeah. back to, like, regular stuff, because, like, that didn't work, so, like, reboot. And, you know, a lot of hippies did become, like, yuppie sellouts. A lot of them made money in tech, especially, and then there's that sort of that technocratic capitalism. It's, like, there's a lot of, like, Steve Jobsiness mm-hmm. to the Rajneeshis.
Oh, totally.
Of, like, you know, do what you feel and yeah. also buy a lot of diamonds.
Oh, man. When the Hollywood crowd gives him the Rolex.
Oh, I was just talking about that because the Hollywood crowd. So Tazia, is that her name?
Yeah. Hasia, I think.
Hasia.
Yeah.
She, because I looked her up because at one point they're like, she produced The Godfather.
Did. Yeah.
I was like, look into that.
Yeah.
And it was because she was married to yeah. Albert Ruddy, who produced The Godfather.
Yeah, they show them at like the Oscars and stuff.
Yeah, and that is obviously, that's the thing is you're like, I would love to see a map of like all the other cults that were going on at the same time. Because like, when did the Source family end?
Right.
Like, you know, a lot of these things like petered out over a long period of time. Some of them more quickly than others. There's like the Timothy Leary cult that he started that... You know, a lot of people like bought farmland and were like, let's try some stuff. And mm-hmm. then in that one, I think somebody took too much acid and died in a lake.
Mm. Yeah.
And then everybody left. Because that's the thing is you're like, there is a little bit of like, where do the limitations and boundaries come in?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, who has to be the grown up in these situations? Yeah. It's like making sure people don't drown.
Well, the fascinating part of this cult in particular is just like, that it's not like negligence or everybody just being so loosey goosey that somebody just falls in a lake and drowns. It's like, oh no, they were actually like, they had a deep state.
Like, it was a tight ship.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you have to hand it to them, but that's, of course, as soon as they start, really, as soon as they start accumulating the guns.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's like, how do you stop the cult from turning into a militia?
Yeah.
Or can
yeah.
you
yeah.
even ever stop that? Or does it always just turn into a militia?
Well, hey, let's take a night call.
Good as time as any.
Hey there. This is Max calling in. First of all, I just want to say thank you for the podcast. I am an insomniac, so appropriately enough. And it's often 1 or 2 in the morning when I'm listening. And I do deal with loneliness and depression, so it's nice during those long, lonely nights to have a sympathetic voice to listen to. But anyway, actually kind of on that subject, because of all the negativity going on in the world these days, I thought of asking you all to say what you like about each other the most. So Molly, tell Tess and Emily what you like about them, and Emily and Tess, you do the same thing, and you know, be real here, I mean, I know you guys are real, but like, this might get intense. Like, make each other blush. And also, which one of you is the id, which one is the ego, and which is the super ego? You guys are great. Thank you very much for contributing to my insomnia, but also to my happiness. And peace and love. See ya.
Peace and love.
Peace and love.
Thanks for calling, Max.
I feel like Max wants us to just have a like group therapy session as a podcast.
I mean, we're like 11 episodes in now. It's time.
It is time.
We got to do a check-in. We got to do an emotional check-in. It makes me happy that people are actually listening to anytime anybody calls in and says that they actually listen to it at night. It's very heartwarming to me for some reason.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for listening.
Using as intended.
Yeah.
Who's the id, you guys? Do we go around?
I feel like I have mine pretty clearly, but I'm wondering if everybody else is going to be different just because.
Okay, you do yours because you have it, and now I want to know.
Yeah.
Okay. Molly is the id, I'm the ego, and Tess is a superego.
Wow.
That's what I thought.
I'm the
really?
Id.
Really? Yeah, you're the id. That's the only one I feel really strongly about. But
I thought Emily, I think maybe you're the id.
Whoa.
I thought you were the id.
I can't be the id. I started like just the nature of this podcast and our original Life is Girls and Hoodies, me being the editor between you two, I can never be the id of this podcast. I'm always going to be either the ego or super ego. It's just impossible.
I was struggling with Emily, which of us was the ego and which is the super ego. And I was like, I think it's whoever has more guilt. I think it's me.
I wanted to, I know this isn't exactly the question, but I really want to force this on you, which is Cheers astrology, which I now believe is real.
Oh, tell me.
I was like tweeting, because I was watching a lot of Cheers, and I was like, guys, I think
wait, have
I'm
you,
like.
You've been watching a lot of Cheers, Molly? I haven't.
Yeah, did you know?
I haven't
finished
heard about
it,
this.
Actually, I finished the whole show, watched all 11 seasons.
Wow, congratulations.
No regrets. Thanks. Really making good use of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I was like, I'm a Carla with a Lilith rising, like as a joke. And then somebody like wrote me a message and was like, I've been listening to you for like a long time, and like you're actually like, here's what I think you are and why. And they
what
were
did
like,
they
you're
think?
Not
they
a Lilith like, rising though.
They were like, you're a Rebecca because like you're cynical and you have like a deep voice, and you have a Diane rising because you like use big words a lot. And
I can see that.
And I was like, oh my god, they like read me to the ground. Like
I kind of.
Right.
I kind of feel like you're a Diane Woody rising.
I like that. I like a little
that
Woody.
As well.
But then I wanted to see what you guys think you are.
Oh man, I have no idea. I'd
have to have just watched 11 seasons to know.
I feel I always remember whenever I go back in and do a run of it. I've never watched the whole thing all the way through, but I always feel a very strong affinity for Cliff Clavin.
What?
But
Cliff sucks.
I'm sorry. It's just
the show is like Cliff is one of those characters who at first I was like, he's so new and weird, and then by the end they all just are like, fuck off, Cliff. Like, amen.
I haven't seen the end.
So maybe you're a Cliff with a Norm rising? Is that what you're saying?
God, that's sad.
I was going to diagnose you as the rare double Lilith.
What?
Oh my God. I like, the double Lilith is strong. That's like a double Virgo or something.
Tess, I think you might be, I think you're.
There's Norm in there. I know this.
No, I think you're a Diane with a Sam Malone rising.
It's really hard to say. I mean, I feel very like emotionally removed from Cheers. It's been a long time since I watched Cheers.
You're
I've been
like
living vicariously.
You're a little
it's hard
Bostonian.
I got yeah.
I think
a little,
you're more
Bostonian
than either of us. We'll say
I'm
that.
A little Bostonian too. Tess and I have a real high tolerance for Boston.
Well, you guys went to school on the East Coast, which I feel is more formative than me moving here almost in my 30s.
Also, Molly's mom.
My mom is from Boston.
Is from Boston.
Oh,
both
right.
of my parents are from Boston.
Yeah. We like love a Massachusetts accent.
Oh, I know. And we a lot of clam cakes between us. Yeah.
High tolerance.
High tolerance. I could do a Soprano astrology.
Oh yeah.
Is
maybe,
probably where I would. I think.
Let's think about that for next week.
Okay, perfect.
But I think cheer astrology is real. Astrology might not be real, but cheer astrology is real.
Speaking of insomnia, spring is here, and I don't know about you guys, but I always feel really exhausted during spring because it's not summer yet, and it's still kind of winter, and it's still definitely winter in New York, which sucks right now. But a good night's sleep can always counteract that. And right now, Lisa Mattresses is offering the biggest discount they've ever offered, which you can take advantage of if you go to lisa.com/nightcall. It's $125 off their mattress. If you haven't tried a Lisa mattress before, they are insanely comfortable. I think I was always one of those people who thought I needed a really tough mattress or a really firm one because, I don't know, I'm a masochist. But once you sleep on a Lisa mattress, you'll realize like, oh, there is a better way. They have 11,000 plus 5-star reviews and people really know what they're talking about. Lisa mattresses were designed to provide support and pressure relief to every body type and sleeper for a deeper night's sleep. So whether you're a back sleeper, a side sleeper, a stomach sleeper, although don't do stomach sleeping, I've heard that's bad. Train yourself out of it. You get more oxygen to your brain at night, I think, something like that. But no matter how you sleep, Lisa mattresses will be astoundingly comfortable. They are also socially conscious with a mission to end bedlessness in America. And there's one mattress donated for every 10 sold and one tree planted for every order received. And they have donated 23,000 mattresses so far. So they're a company that you can feel great about supporting and also sleeping on. But don't sleep on this. Go to lisa.com/nightcall right now to get $125 off your mattress. Again, this is the deepest discount you're going to find, so you should take advantage of it. And tell them we sent you here at Night Call.
As far as saying nice things about each other, can I just say that one of the nice things that has been really fun to think about recently is that we've been working together for, what, 8 years?
No.
Off and on?
What?
I was thinking about it the other day. Because I wrote my first piece for Grantland, I believe, in 2011. Molly had joined then as well. Emily, I think you came.
I came in 2012. When?
2012.
Yeah.
And so that's when we all started working together.
It sort of has like opened a portal to the last time we all had a show together.
It's strange.
Yeah. Which was totally, I mean, I will say I started the podcast because I was like, still at that point, and it got better over the course of time that I worked there, but there were about, I think, 3 total Grantland female employees. And so I think I desperately wanted to have a corner.
The first name that the podcast was almost when we were like, what should it be called? And they were like, how about Grantland W? And we were like, no.
We spent so many months just being like, no.
Yeah.
No W.
Yeah, no
just
W.
Just regular.
But I mean, it's kind of cool when you think about how many people do you work with, you know, over that amount of time, and you take breaks and you come back together. Because when we first started working together, it was a different world.
Yeah,
you guys.
I get very emo thinking about it because I'm like, wow, those people that are my friends from that time are like, we have known each other for a long time now, but obviously I'm always still like 5 or 6 years behind where I actually reality is. So I'm like, that was just yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, it was a long time ago.
And it's also like the industry has changed so much. I mean, when we all started working together, it just, everything looked completely different and the optimism was completely different. And I think it's kind of amazing for me to see what you guys have done since then and how you've continued to kind of work separately. Like, we've all been doing our own things, but I pretty regularly have been checking in about what we're all interested in. And
there was never a moment when I didn't like wish we still had a show.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Me too. And I mean, during the last Girls in Hoodies, when I called in, I cried.
We cried.
Oh man.
So I think it's cool when you admire the people that you work with so much that you kind of seek them out across different places, you know.
Emily scrubbed her Facebook and she sent this message that she had sent to me on Facebook that was like a fan email before we were friends that I totally never got or I would have responded to. I didn't like read it and be like, because Emily was like, you probably read this, and we're like, you're a stalker.
Well, it was because we had a lot of friends in common, and I think you had liked something of mine on Facebook, and then I was like, hey, I should like strive a conversation with Molly because we have so many friends in common, and then it didn't happen for like 3 more years or something.
But it was like that, you know, that optimistic internet time also when we were all on Tumblr and we were like making friends through the internet and being like, this is cool. Like, it's no longer sketchy to make friends through the internet. It's like you meet people that write things you like online and then you meet them in real life and they're kind of like the person that you met online.
Yeah.
Although some people are totally different in real life and that's also really weird.
Well, now, I mean, at this point we have old friends who are internet friends, whereas it always seemed like those were going to be kind of
your new friends.
interesting.
Yeah,
exactly. They're your new friends. They're not like your close friends. But, it, you know, now I've seen.
It's a certain kind of, there are people that you're like intimate with on the internet at like a certain level of like maybe you've never met them, but you like, quote unquote, know them for like a decade.
Yeah, now it's been, now you have old friends who are your internet friends and some of them end up getting married. I've seen two couples from Tumblr get married, have kids. Yeah.
Oh, man.
It's fun. But anyway,
I think
one of
you're
the things
the first
that
person
I love
on Tumblr
about
I ever witnessed
that.
Get married, Tess.
Oh, really? Hey. But I didn't marry a Tumblr person, so it's not as special.
It's not as spicy.
Objectively. Yeah, it's not as spicy.
Probably bodes better for the...
A pre-wedding hashtags time.
But I'm actually, I feel like I'm closest with the female friends that I've made from the internet. And I don't really, I mean, I guess it's because if you're straight and you're making opposite gender friends on the internet, you have a high probability of like one of you creeping the other out at some point. But
yeah.
But it's nice because, you know, we're old internet friends and real friends. And it's been, we've been podding in one form or another for a while. So I appreciate that about
internet
you.
Friends.
Internet friends.
I'm going to say one, I'm going to say really quickly two nice things about one nice thing about each of you, rather. Tess, I think you have very good intuition about everything that you like and don't like and believe in. And I think I'm more wishy-washy, so I admire that. And Molly, I think you are probably the most curious person I know, which is a great quality. That's all.
Oh, that's nice. Guys. Wait, did I say nice things about you? I'm going to.
No, you didn't.
You don't have to. I was just thinking.
No, I want to. I like this question. Emily, I think you're a brilliant genius. Tess, I also think you're a brilliant genius. I love you guys. And it's cool to be on the internet radio again together.
Okay, okay. Let's take a different night call. We're done.
Night call, guys. Guys, I got allergies. I got to go. Bye.
Hey, friends. It's 1:15 in the morning on a Tuesday, which in my life means I'm just finished up with tabletop RPG night during the week and returned home, occasionally scouring the internet for new ideas or games we might play in the future. And stumbled upon a post from Reddit user Funnel27 that is a Frasier RPG, tabletop RPG entitled Boss Dragons and Scrambled Eggs. So obviously, I thought of the three of you, and whether or not you've had any experience with tabletop RPGs, and if so, if you'd be interested in playing an RPG with Niles, Frasier, Lilith, and Daphne. Have a good evening.
Well, yes, I have played tabletop RPGs. You guys haven't? I don't remember.
No, we're not nerds.
I don't know
right.
Is.
I always
just
forget.
Googled
I'm the only nerd.
It was played.
Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's like the one
you play with pen and paper and dice. Like,
yeah, then I have. Yeah.
You have?
Well, I played Dungeons and Dragons in junior high.
You did?
You knew that.
No, I did not. I like didn't do it, I think, because I was like, Tess would think it was uncool.
Only once or twice, okay? Only once or twice.
There were like some kids who played magic in the break room, I remember.
I played a little magic in the break
you
room.
You did?
But only like once or twice.
Oh my God. You don't need to downplay it. Be proud, Tess. Be proud.
No, but the problem was that I had trouble understanding the rules.
Well, yeah, I don't like those kinds of games because there are too many rules.
It was awful because I was ashamed and then I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And I started doing it and then it made me feel dumb and bad at being a nerd. And so it wasn't even the uncoolness. It was my ineptitude that made me not want to do it anymore.
I can't deal with structured gameplay.
Well, Molly will be like, let's play Scrabble. And then it'll get to just the point where you're winning. And she'll be like, I got to get out of here.
That's just one time.
I have a place to be. And you're like, you know, you have to play Scrabble. And, you know, it's not like Molly's been going really fast and everyone else is taking like a long time. Everybody's doing their best.
I get too antsy.
And then Molly's got to go.
Games take too long. The only game that doesn't take too long is Boggle.
I know. Boggle's the best game.
That's funny because my experience, and I don't think this is a bad thing at all, because I also like, I like board games a lot. And I think people who like, I think that it is, I tend to think of it with anxiety in my mind. Like if you tend to be antsy or have social anxiety or like maybe like, I don't know, like it's tough, then a board game is always reliable because you're like, an interaction I can do. Like, I think that's a lot
I'm always like, you know, what's a great interaction is just talking.
Talking.
Yeah.
And
We played Uno at a bar for a while.
Yeah, we did play Uno at a bar.
And that was really fun.
That was fun. I do like Uno. I like Uno. I also like, I like video game RPGs a lot. Those are my favorite video games.
Yeah, because they're
Japanese
the chillest.
RPGs from the 90s. Mystical Ninja, greatest game of all time.
Yeah. I mean, I like tabletop RPGs. I like, I think I got really obsessed with the idea of running one, like doing, like creating a campaign.
Being a dungeon master?
Being a dungeon master. And
I think you're the dungeon master of this podcast a little bit.
You are.
Well, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, and that shit is hard because I like playing tabletop RPGs, but I have to be told what to do all the time because I'm never quite... Like, you know, I never really know when to do a saving throw or something like that. Usually
yeah,
if I've been playing
for
a second.
Hard.
Yeah. But
it's hard. It shouldn't be hard.
I love just, I love creating a character. Like when I was in high school, I played a fair amount of games. I played like probably mostly the World of Darkness games, like Vampire.
What are those? What is that?
It's like Vampire the Masquerade and shit. It's like the stuff
I love how like I'm like making fun of you guys for being nerds when like I like all kinds of other things that are just as nerdy, just not this specific one.
Yeah. But I mean, honestly, I would spend most of my, I probably played it, you know,
so
less than
World
10
of
times.
Darkness. Is like a interview with the vampire theme.
It's modern gothic horror.
Oh my god.
It's a collection of games and they can kind of be used together if you want, but then there are ones that are just for magicians called Mage the Ascension, and there's one called and the vampire one is the most famous one. That's Vampire the Masquerade. There's a werewolf one. There's a
But you just really breezed past Vampire the Masquerade. Where does the Masquerade come in?
The Masquerade is the collective act of vampires to live among humans undetected. It is the Masquerade. The Masquerade.
Okay, cool, Lestat.
Yeah. So there's all these different classes of vampires that you can be on. They all have different. So there's like the artsy romantic ones, and there's like the like blue blood ones, and they're.
Who is your character?
There's like an academic class of them. No. That's a mage. I had a character that was one of those.
Mage.
Yeah, I don't
Who
remember.
Who is your mage?
That was like a professor. It was like a professor.
Professor of vampires?
Maybe. I don't. Yeah. I think.
No, it's me, Professor Bloodthirst. I live amongst you. Don't look at me in a mirror too closely.
I'm a doctor of phlebotomy.
my basement apartment. Don't look too close.
But that one is like you know, well, there is a species of the vampire ones that are called like the Nosferatu vampires, where you look like Nosferatu and you're so ugly and scary that like immediately people run away from you. Like that's just built. If you're gonna be that kind of character, it's just like part of it is you're never gonna be able to like you know con your
be
way
part
into
of the
human.
Masquerade?
Yeah, no, you won't. You have to hide out. But
that's such an allegory for being a teen.
Totally.
No wonder they loved it.
Nos Fraseratu.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying
So would you guys be down for a Fraser RPG?
Totally. Yeah. I feel like it would be the Fraser RPG would not be, it wouldn't be like, I mean, you could do one where you're just playing as the central cast, but I feel like a more interesting open version of the game would be like a Seattle 90s role-playing game. So you could,
you know what this should be? It should be a CD-ROM.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me, you remember Jesse, an ex of mine, but he always wanted to do a show that took place in a cafe in the 90s in Seattle, like just as like a world. That it
just
existed
like the people
in.
That live next to Fraser.
Yeah. Like the people, like
well,
the staff of Cafe Nervosa, basically.
I've been getting really into side stories just as like a thing that I know is like a big thing in anime. Where
yeah.
It's like, oh, another story that takes place during the main story that everyone knows. There's like a Battle Royale one. That's
yeah.
Like, hey, here's some other kids who were trapped during Battle Royale.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I do love the idea of just like, yeah, like who is like the Gunther of Fraser? Who's like, like a bulldog,
yeah,
you know, a bulldog plot line,
yeah,
about
or like
bulldog's secret life.
Yeah, I feel like you could have, you know, the different classes would be like, I mean, they would be literal classes. They would be like socioeconomic classes, and there would be things that you wouldn't be able to do if you were pulling minimum wage at Cafe Nervosa that you would be able to do if you were part of the wine club or the opera club or something.
and then there should be like the movie Singles. There should be like a cast.
Yeah.
From there. like a grunge cast.
Yeah, well, totally.
I mean, Emily, if you were wanting to do an RPG, this may be the one to do now that we're discussing
well,
it.
Well, it's sort of hard to, I mean, Dungeons and Dragons has the most familiar rules to most people. So theoretically is best to build off of to make something, but there are also parts of it that are just like inescapably Dungeons and Dragons-y, like just like the way you do combat, like having an axe instead of a, you know, I don't, it's just like kind of some of it is inescapably fantasy oriented. Because I wanted to do one that was set in a post-apocalyptic Portland. and I had kind of mapped it out like I was using an actual city map and everything.
I think the theme of this episode is post-apocalyptic Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, exactly. That's the theme of every episode
that
in a way.
Well, there's something very, I think, compelling about how everything, like instead of things kind of turning to dust or something and in the plains or in the desert,
oh, yeah,
or something,
that it all turns green.
Yeah, it becomes annihilation.
It's annihilation. Yeah,
yeah. You're just in like bright green emerald moss all over, yeah. Like eating buildings.
I love when stuff goes back to nature.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of going back to nature,
yeah,
we asked for some ghost stories and you guys really delivered. If you have a ghost story that you would like to share, you can give us a call at 240-46-NIGHT or email us at nightcallpodcast@gmail.com. Just keep throwing that at you. but I think we should take some ghost story night calls, you guys.
Yeah, let's take some night stories.
Hey, Night Call, this is Kate. I'm calling with a spooky story for you. It's something that has happened to me recently. In the past couple of weeks, probably 2 weeks, I've been getting calls from a private number. So I assume someone who has, I think, *67 their number. So I can't see the number. It's private, blocked. And the first couple of times I missed it or ignored it because who answers private numbers? And it never left a message. Then finally I picked it up. I was in a car with some friends and I put it on speaker just to be like, what's going on? And the first thing I hear is, hello, like the ice cream truck thing, that voice that's like, hello. And then it starts with an ice cream truck song. I can't remember if it's the Scott Joplin song or Do Your Ears Hang Low or whatever. But anyway, it's a recording of the ice cream truck, and it just loops. So obviously I was pretty freaked out, and I kept getting the calls for the next couple of days, and I only answered it like one or two more times, but each time it was the exact same thing, and luckily it just so then I just started ignoring them, obviously, and it never left a message, so that was the biggest blessing, because I hate voicemails, especially creepy ice cream truck loops. But so this got me thinking, if you all have ever had an experience that made you feel like you were actually trapped in, a horror film. But luckily the calls have actually stopped. I almost hesitated to make this call because I didn't want to jinx anything. So anyway, that's my spooky story. And let me know what you think. Okay. Bye.
That is very disconcerting. that did not go where I thought it was going to go.
Yeah, that's so scary.
It's terrifying. And it's so funny because we got a bunch of ghost stories, and some of them I feel like had more kind of like,
who knows,
on their face scary, yeah, things. But this one was, it stuck with me.
Oh, it's so unsettling. The ice cream truck music is already a little scary.
Especially, yeah, the hello.
Hello?
I mean, that's how I answer the phone,
yeah,
when I, hello, pick it up, but not, yeah, not vice versa. Hello, it's me.
Hello.
That is really scary. You know, that goes back to something that I was always really afraid of. I don't know where I would have gotten this idea from. I think it was maybe a Babysitter's Club book, like the second Babysitter's Club book, I want to say, is where there's like a phantom phone caller that's terrifying the babysitters. But the thing of somebody calling and not saying anything, but you can hear breathing on the line and then hanging up, that was always like a big anxiety of mine growing up.
Did it ever happen to you?
Yes, it did happen to me once, and I was home alone. And I remember, oh yeah, no, that was, okay, yeah, this is the one, like, the most insane, like, thing I ever did as a freaked out kid, was that I was home alone, this happened to me, and I was so scared, I ran barefoot to our neighbor's house, down the street, and I don't know. I think I left a note for my mom and then just like left as soon as I could because I immediately started thinking about like, how am I going to get out of the house? Will I have to jump out of the window? Like all this stuff. And I remember my neighbor was watching Uli's Gold and that is now my principal association with that movie.
Who's that? Peter Fonda?
Yeah, the Peter Fonda movie about him being a beekeeper.
But the opposite of spookiness.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's a lovely movie. Yeah. Oh, the gold is honey.
Yeah.
Oh, guys. Yeah, there's something very Stephen King-y about that, obviously. Anything that's like a children's thing made spooky. Yeah.
Well, it's like a clown kind of thing, yeah. Too. The janky music.
It's reminding me also of like, now I'm going to reveal that I also am a huge nerd. Who read the Christopher Pike, The Last Vampire.
Oh, I love Christopher Pike.
Did you read those ones ever? The Last Vampire.
So.
They were like a little more violent than some of the others. They're great. And there's one where the girl who's a vampire, I think, like chops someone's head off in, or somebody's head gets chopped off in an ice cream truck. And the dialogue is like, my favorite flavor, like cherry red. This stayed with me forever.
Oh my gosh.
So obviously it was very vivid in my mind.
I actually got a call last week and it was on my landline and I picked up the phone and it was a guy who was like, you're going to go to hell when you die, and then hung up the phone and I Googled the number that it had come in on and it wasn't a recording. It was a real person.
Whoa.
And it's a known thing. It's a very half-assed attempt at like an extortion via like kind of casually thrown together religious group, I guess.
Whoa. It's a known scam.
It's a known scam. And terrifying.
But it was a person on it. It wasn't a recording.
It was a person.
That's so freaky. Because I had a scam happen to me over the weekend, but it was a robocall and it was like a very robot voice, which is sometimes more scary because it sounds like Hal or something. But telling me that I was getting sued by the IRS for like...
the IRS is suing you.
Scary. Yeah. Those phone calls that tell you... I got some calls for a while that were coming from like a Texas prison that scared the hell out of me. And
yikes.
Then I found out it was a scam. But also I was like, who do I know that would be in prison in Texas, like calling me? And I thought about it a lot. And then I found out it was a scam. But I got some heavy breathing calls like a couple years ago on my cell phone. Mm-hmm. And it was like a private number. Couldn't call back. They would just call and like breathe and be creepy.
Ugh.
And then I would hang up. It totally creeped me out. And then I like called the cops to be like, what can I do? And they were like, nothing. Like, there's nothing we can do. They were like, they just didn't care.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know who's calling with the ice cream.
But the ice cream truck is such a specific, like, what are you trying to do?
Yeah.
That's so scary too, because anything like that, I would be like, what are you trying to tell me?
Exactly. Right. What does it mean? It's meant to drive you mad.
Maybe,
like, searching for the
right,
meaning.
Because if it's random, then it's still really weird.
She should record it if she can, or like, yeah, get a recording of it and like zoom and enhance on it, only the audio version of that, and find out
if
there are any
clues.
I'm going
to come up with here's the wholesome answer, is maybe it's like a child calling you from a playground. Accidentally.
Oh, no. Come on.
They're just accidentally calling.
Dream on. It's not that.
There's an ice cream truck just right there. And then
always
just...
at the same point in the song. No way. On loop. No way.
Hello.
Well, maybe by us getting the word out, maybe somebody else will have gotten this too, and we can triangulate and figure out what's going on.
Yeah. If you've gotten a prank call from an ice cream truck ghost,
let us know.
Let us know.
We're here in service of the people.
Maybe it's like a spirit trying to escape from like a Powerpuff Girls like popsicle or something. Like, set me free if you say the right thing.
Oh, weird.
Don't say the right thing.
Thank you so much, Kate, for your call and for giving us nightmares for the next few weeks. And thank you, everybody, for listening to Night Call. Be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes if you aren't already and leave us a review. We love reviews. The more, the merrier. You can also follow us on Twitter at Night Call Pod, Facebook at Night Call Podcast, and Instagram at Night Call Podcast. And as always, give us a night call at 240-46-NIGHT. That's 240-46-NIGHT, or nightcallpodcast@gmail.com. That's all.
We'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week. Bye.
Goodbye.
Hello.